Welcome to the Soho Forum, a monthly debate series that features topics of special interest to libertarians and aims to enhance social and professional ties within New York City's libertarian community. We're partnered with Reason Magazine in presenting these debates, and you can catch audio of all our events on the Reason podcast, which you'll find in the iTunes store. I'd also like to thank the Smith Family Foundation for making this series possible. I'm Gene Epstein, economics and books editor at Barron's Financial Weekly and the Soho Forum director and moderator. For more information and to buy tickets to our future debates, go to our website at thesohoforum.org. This is an Oxford-style debate in which the audience initially votes for, against, or undecided on the resolution, and then again after the debate is over. Whichever side moves the vote in his or her favor wins the contest. Today's resolution is as follows. America's colleges have fostered a racist environment that makes them a hostile space for African American students. Defending the resolution, to my right, we have Lawrence Ross, author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Lawrence will be doing book signing and sales of his book, Blackballed, after the debate. You'll find Lawrence over there at that table signing books and talking in response to any questions you want to put to him after the debate. Arguing for the negative, we have Camille Foster, a telecommunications entrepreneur and a host and a co-host of the libertarian podcast, The Fifth Column. Got to deal with those Fifth Column fans out there.
I came from Los Angeles. They're
dominating. So now we will close the initial voting, and the debate can begin. Lawrence Ross, you have 15 minutes to defend the proposition America's colleges have fostered a racist environment that makes them a hostile space for African American students. Take it away, Lawrence.
There will never be a nigga SAE. There will never be a nigga SAE. You can hang it from a tree, but it'll never sign with me. There will never be a nigga SAE. Now, how many of you guys heard that song before? How many thought I lost my mind, including Jane? That song was sung by two young men, two young white members of Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter at the University of Oklahoma, and they had learned it from about five or six different white fraternity members in the Midwest. And everyone was shocked when they saw this video, and it went on, it went viral, and everybody, even Fox News. Fox News thought to himself, yeah, this actually might be a little bit racist. But because we Americans like to think that racism is some sort of extraordinarily long series of unfortunate events that are isolated, what we did not know is that this was not the first time a white fraternity has sung about murdering African Americans. No one had really connected the dots, and that's kind of like why I'm here. I connect the dots. Because in 1963, Tau Kappa Epsilon at Cal State Long Beach sang a song that was really reminiscent of Sigma Alpha Epsilon. They sang a song that said, "Bye bye, black boy, you better play it cool or else we'll bomb your Sunday school." Now, they were talking about the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, where four little black girls died. Now, is this a coincidence? No, it's not a coincidence. This is just the tip of the iceberg. As I tell my wife, it's kind of a amuse-bouche of the types of campus racism that you see on a regular basis on college campuses. The average when I was doing research for Blackballed was between 350 to 500 racist incidents on college campuses that are reported. This is just the reported. Now, what type of campus racism incidents are we talking about? You know, what are the ones that we normally see? Well, do you want white students in white fraternities and sororities dressing up in blackface on Halloween and Martin Luther King's birthday and black history? All the time, in a series almost every particular year. You want to have people dress up in Bloods and Crips trying to mimic, quote-unquote, African-Americans? Happens all the time. You want to see white students dress eating watermelon and fried chicken and declaring that they're celebrating black heritage? Happens every single year. And do you want to see the word nigger sprayed anywhere? Eastern Michigan happened this year. It just happened at SUNY Brockport just a couple of months ago. Happens on a regular basis. Bananas thrown at black students? American University, it happened twice in 1 year at American University. Just happened a couple of weeks ago. East Tennessee State University had a white guy, who decided to put a gorilla mask on his face and then hand out bananas to students who are members of Black Lives Matter. It's not something that we, I almost forgot about the Confederate flags and the nooses. Confederate flags and nooses that have been associated in terms of the pictures that we have this associated with fraternities like Kappa Sigma, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, Kappa Alpha, almost always happen on a regular basis. Sometimes it's part of organized chapter events. And we see this in social media, but it goes back to the 40s and 50s and 60s. So this is not campus racism. Get it out of your head that campus racism is just simply coming is a new event. It's not something that is brand new simply because we have social media. I saw, in terms of my research, I saw campus racism issues in newspapers, in archives, in yearbooks, every particular place you can pretty much find it. But one of the problems is that when we talk about campus racism, what we tend to do is we want to say that racism for on college campuses is pretty much wherever the other is. If we want to talk about it in terms of saying, well, campus racism is only in the South because, you know, University of Alabama in particular, which does have its own racism issues. Well, you know, that's an easy place to stick it. But no, it happens at Missouri, Yale, Columbia, Berkeley, my alma mater, UCLA, every single place, whether or not it's a small college or a private college or state college, it happens in every particular place. But here's the problem. I'm not going to get into listing every single racist event that occurs during this 15 minutes. The one problem that black people have in terms of trying to talk about racism is that quantifying racism by just simply doing numbers will never work. Because I'm pretty sure some of you, if I said 100 different incidents, somebody in the audience would go, yeah, but that's not 105. And I need 105 to be really sure that racism actually occurs on these campuses. So that's a game of whack-a-mole that I'm not going to play. But what I do want to do is talk about specifically, you know, what are students, you know, specifically trying to do when they come on those campuses and what happens to them? These college students are coming, these black college students are coming on these campuses specifically to get an education. And what is happening is that the university itself and the, what we talk about in terms of college universities is creating a hostile environment, which gets us to the resolution. Now, I want to reread the resolution because I wanted to do a little breakdown of it. America's colleges have fostered a racist environment that makes them hostile spaces for African-American students. Now, I do have a little bit quibble with the resolution a little bit, Gene, although he helped me approve it. The issue is that when we talk about environment, we use racist as an adjective for the noun environment, as though the environment itself is neutral, as though it is racist-free, does not contain racism. But it's just people from the outside who are creating a racist environment. Now, I'm going to, you know, argue for the affirmative, but I still don't believe that. The environment is as part of America as any other place, so that therefore we should not make the assumption that the environment itself is non-racist. We just shouldn't. America does not have any sense of a history that tells us we have non-racist or racialized environments. But, you know, this kind of goes back to one of the earliest studies done by African-American sociologist W.B. Du Bois, who in 1909 went and recognized that there was an issue with colleges and colleges being a part of America. And he did a 1909 study, asked a racial climate study. He said, well, look, what is the racial climate on your college campus? And some, because they were restricted, because African-Americans were not allowed on those campuses, there was no survey there. But there were ones who said, well, you know, we treat the African-American students exactly like the white students. And the other ones were like, never bring them on our campus because we cannot actually deal with their safety. But, you know, it's easy for us when we talk about, you know, college campuses to think of college campuses pretty much as what I call educational Disneylands. You know, we think of, you know, them as being idyllic utopian spaces, you know, free speech land over there, you know, critical thinking land over here, pass out drunk land is a little bit over there, but nobody ever remembers it. And, you know, we even talk about it as being ivory towers, you know, and I always like to read the definition for ivory towers. It's a state of privileged seclusion and separation from the facts and practicalities of the world. But colleges and universities are not separate from the real world, and they're not separate from the American society. And how do we define colleges and universities? And a lot of times when I have these discussions, we talk about colleges as being some kind of like, you know, off over here, institutional or the administration. You know, the colleges and universities are composed of a number of elements. The students, the faculty, the administration, yes. The fraternities and sororities, the traditions, the buildings, the campus, all of those work together. All of those work together. So the problem is that if you have a racist environment, you by nature have a hostile space. I've yet to go on a college campus where the people say, well, the environment is racist, but you know, it's also warm and inviting. It doesn't happen like that. You know, it's not like that. And also, you have to also remember that hostility is not really just a quantifiable fact. The quantifiable fact is that we have all these racist incidents. That is without dispute. But it's also a qualifiable fact in terms of how do black students feel when they get on campus? Do they feel welcome when they get on a campus? And that is not something that other people can tell them that they must feel welcome or they must overcome some sort of racist hurdle in order to just say, well, I feel welcome on this campus. It is a responsibility of the campus to provide them with an atmosphere that allows them to get an education without the hurdle of racism. But one of the things that we also want to talk about is that we can't talk about racism without getting specifically to the root of it, which, of course, is white supremacy. Now, I saw some faces scrunches up, and that's my bad. That's my bad. I should have given you guys a trigger warning that I was going to say white supremacy and make this a safe space for all of y'all. But, you know, before, let's just get into it. But when I say white supremacy, get out of your head, the David Dukes of the world. I'm not talking about the cliches. I'm talking about whiteness being the default normal and blackness being the other. Whiteness being the fully human and blackness being not human. And that's where you get the denigration of black students in terms of looking at black students as not being fully human. But so let's take some of the low-hanging fruit, something that even if you don't believe that, look at in terms of what African-American students have to deal with when they walk on particular campuses. For example, Georgetown just had to apologize for having sold 272 enslaved Africans in order to keep the doors open. We're not just talking about Harvard Law, had in its seal the royal family, a slaveholding family, who had burned alive 100 Africans in order to put down a slave rebellion. Or my favorite place, Clemson, which I do love these people. Clemson, which is located on the John C. Calhoun Plantation, that is, which was one of the leading slavery advocates, which is also hosts the Ben Pitchfork Tillman Hall, who advocated for the lynching of thousands of African Americans, which is about 500 yards from the Strom Thurmond building, which is the anti-civil rights senator who was one of the longest senators in the Senate. Senate history, I joked to them that the only thing they did not have was a KKK quad. And then 2 weeks ago, they actually did have the KKK come to distribute flyers. That is the atmosphere that you have on multiple campuses around this country. And that's some of the history that you have in terms of how African Americans see themselves on these campuses. A lot of times, these are not historical relics for African American students. These are realities. We always talk about the fact that no one would ask African American students to go over this if they looked at them as being fully human. But why just specifically college campuses? It doesn't really happen. I studied it. It doesn't happen on high school or elementary school campuses. But the reason I think why African American students in particular are attacked is because college is an economical, educational, and sociological transformation. And in essence, it's a battlefield for whether or not you're going to uphold white supremacy or whether or not you're going to transform it in society. Therefore, the presence of African Americans or students on campuses is a direct threat. So that means that people then decide to attack that threat. One of the other reasons is that white students typically come on college campuses completely segregated. African-American students and white students do not go to the same schools and do not live in the same neighborhoods. 74% of African-American students live in go to a segregated school, with 38% of them going to a segregated K-12 school before they get to college. And it's around 80% or so for white students coming to college. But in spite of all that, a 2016 Baylor study said that in terms of how white students looked at African-American students, they said they did not try hard enough on college campuses, despite how hard it was to get to campus. But so one of the problems is that if you do not see an African-American student as a fully human person, you will find that person easy to denigrate. Or, for example, you will not see that person as a college student. For example, at LSU, they had an epidemic of so many white students calling the LSU police department and saying that they had a African-American male that they needed to investigate, that the police had to do an open letter and tell the student body to stop sending the police talking to African-American men who were just simply coming from the library. At Colgate, a young woman just was talking about the fact that she walked around a white student walked around with a metal sword and talked about the fact that a year before, no one stopped her, and a young African-American black student walked around with a glue gun for his art for his art project, and the police shut down the whole campus because of how people thought one being a student and one not being a student. So am I saying that all the white students and the white faculty and white administrators are all raging white supremacists? Of course not. Although I think my friend Camille might want to tell me to say that I am. I am not saying that. But I will say that white students and administrators and faculty are coming to campuses with various aspects. What they're doing, you have some who are anti-racist, who are looking at racism and saying, I am going to help deconstruct this racist society. I'm going to deconstruct it on this college campus. You have some people who are genuinely racist, who decide, yeah, I just can't wait until I get here because this is a space for me to be racist. But most people are not any of that. Most of them, or most people in the world, and most white students and administrators and faculty, typically are non-racist. But non-racist looks a little bit different. Non-racism is this idea that, well, you know, something I believe in an egalitarian society, a colorblind society. I voted for Obama, so how can I be racist? And they put a moral justification behind racism versus sitting up and saying, well, you know, I can do something. As long as it's over there, I don't have to do something. It's somebody else's issue. Inside Higher Education did a study with 700 white college presidents, and they asked them, what is the racial climate on your college campus? 90% came back in 2015 and said, the racial climate on our college campus is absolutely fine, good or excellent. Then there were about 250 different campus protests. They did it again in 2016, which you would think, well, it would go down, right? Because obviously things are not really good. It went up. They were 90%, but the numbers of college presidents who said excellent went up. So what happens is there's a cognitive dissonance. For example, it's not just with the college presidents, it's also with the students. There was a young woman named Paige Schumacher at Kansas State who made a decision to paint her face black, throw up a gang sign and say, finally feels good to be a nigga. And when she did that, the newspaper came back to her and said, well, why did you do this? And she said, well, I am the least racist person that you know. And I was thinking to myself, if you're the least racist person that you know, who is the most racist person that you know?
Lawrence, you got 30 seconds to go.
Thank you. Well, I know my friend Camille right here is going to say, well, look, racism, you know, he doesn't like racism like anybody else. You know, who likes racism? Like saying, I love cancer. No one likes that. But what he will do is what institutions do, what I call three I's equals a miss. He will individualize, minimize, and then trivialize it, and then dismiss the concerns. He will say that all these are individual incidents. He will also look at them in terms of minimizing. He will think to himself, well, you know, maybe black students are being hyper, you know, sensitive to all these things. And then he'll trivialize it probably by picking out some incidents that didn't turn out the way that we thought they were. But a lot of times that is what actually makes African-American students mad, because they're dismissed. And I always want to go back to what this one student said. She said, I didn't come to the University of Oklahoma, going back to SAE, for campus racism protests. I came to be an engineer. But she quickly understood what James Baldwin said. One of the paradoxes of education was that precisely at this point, when you begin to develop a conscience, you must find yourself at war with your society. It is your responsibility to change society if you think of yourself as an educated person.
Thank you, Lawrence. Yeah. Camille Foster, 15 minutes to speak against the resolution. Take it away, Camille.
Great. Well, I'll only need about three of those, since Lawrence already explained the tactic that I'm going to use to deconstruct his argument, except he's wrong. First, thanks so much to Eugene, and thanks to Naomi and John and the rest of the Soho Forum crowd, and thanks to all of you for being here. Lawrence, thank you for coming and taking on what is a very difficult and challenging task, trying to prove this really assertive claim about universities being hostile environments. My suspicion is that most of the people in this room who take an interest in something like this are probably university educated. I would imagine that wasn't their experience. And I'm not imagining that because I'm just going to, you know, why not contrive something? I'm going to consult to study like you did, except it's not one that is well over 100 years old. It's one from about a year ago. In fact, I'll consult two of them. In both of those studies, we saw the students overwhelmingly say that they thought the race relations on their campus were good or excellent. Not only, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah,
this is the other. I'm at a severe disadvantage here in that I do not like monologues. The notion of talking for 15 minutes is not very exciting to me. But I'm going to try to keep it going for all of you guys. Also, Lawrence has been studying this stuff a heck of a lot longer than I have. But I'm going to try to make an empirical case, as you see. And when I say empirical, it's not just a matter of citing numbers. It's a matter of making some claims. If there are some claims, then what would we expect to see? And I certainly don't think we would expect to see 75% of students on campus saying that they're pleased to be there, that they're happy, that they think that the race relations on their campus are fine and good. In fact, even Black students say that. But it is certainly true that Black students say that to a lesser degree. What's even more interesting from my standpoint is that these hostile, racist environments, when I decided to take a look at this a little bit more closely, I went and took a look at the top 10 and the top 25 universities, both top 10 private universities, U.S. News and World Report, top 25 public universities. And on every single one of those campuses, every single one of them, they have a chancellor of diversity of some sort. In fact, oftentimes, there are multiple people who hold that title. These small fiefdoms, they rule over the entire campus, adjudicating various wrongs and making students feel, one hopes, safer. Not only that, every single one of these campuses has an African-American student studies program, an accredited one, where you could actually get a degree. You could graduate. You could spend your entire time studying that. Many of these campuses have diversity credits that you earn for taking these classes on campus. Some of this stuff did, well, that in particular didn't exist when I was in school. But suffice it to say, there are significant investments being made in pursuit of this goal. And it's no surprise then, this goal of creating diversity on campus, and it's no surprise then that since, I believe, the late 1970s up until about 2015, the share of 18 to 25-year-olds African-Americans in secondary, post-secondary education has increased by almost 100%, twice the rate of white students. Why are they rushing to go to these hostile, racist environments? And why, at a time when they're supposed to be awash in all of these anecdotal cases of racial outrage that is being directed towards them, is the FBI reporting that they're actually seeing far less reports of hate crimes on their campuses? I'm not exactly sure, but it may have something to do with the fact that many of these students who in the same survey had said that they believe their college environment is a lot safer, is producing the sort of race relations that one would expect, excellent, good, probably consistent with your own experience at school, many of them were deeply concerned about the state of Black America. They were concerned about Black people in general. And they were also concerned about the state of race relations on other campuses. What is that? Interestingly, I think that there is the very strong possibility that some of the programs that have been put into place to try and ameliorate imagined wrongs, to try and create a campus environment that is more equitable and more equal and more fair, and that celebrates the traditions of all of the students that are on campus, rather than bringing those students together, may in fact be creating some divisions. It may in fact be highlighting the things about one another that make them different, rather than highlighting the things about one another that make them the same. What sort of stuff would that be? Perhaps really charged language like white supremacy, like privilege. What on earth are those things? We were just told that white supremacy is something that is not necessarily what's practiced by the Klan, but effectively some sort of force that is behind almost everything that you do and everything that is around you and everything that surrounds you. That there is an unbroken continuum from the founding of this country, from chattel slavery on through Jim Crow, on up into your campus where there is a young white girl at the University of Maryland, my alma mater, who was photographed in front of a cake. And the cake says the words, suck a nigga dick. That is a very strange phrase. Where does it come from? Lil Wayne. They're the lyrics to a rap song. This was one of the myriad anecdotes that was brought to bear in support of the case that these campuses are awash in racism. I don't think it would make a hell of a lot of sense for me to cherry pick the various incidents of supposed racism. And I say supposed not because I'm denigrating it, but because what is racism? What is a trigger? These are subjective assessments in many cases. Certainly once you get from a situation where the state is making determinations about who can attend school at this particular place, if I say to you, you are a credit to your race, have I, in fact, insulted you? If someone sends me a message on my iPad and says, good luck at your debate, kill him. Do I take offense? Do I presume that this is, in fact, a reference to the fact that black people are overrepresented in crime statistics? Is he suggesting that I am, in fact, a violent person as a consequence of it? I don't know. I can't know that. But one can presume. And unfortunately, and I've read Lawrence's book, there are portions of it I agree with, but not many. I'm sorry. But not many. And the one thing I do concede, however, is that there are a number of black people that sort of share the sentiment that's being expressed. The sentiment that if you walk into a store and someone speaks to you, that this person may in fact be trying to affirmatively get in your way and make certain that you're not stealing anything. But simultaneously, the same person might also feel that if they walk in and no one speaks to them, that suddenly it's because, well, they must think I ain't got no money to spend. What sort of cognitive load are you carrying if you are imagining that in every single circumstance, both the existence of programs to ameliorate discrimination and the non-existence of these programs is evidence of the contempt that the world must have towards you? That we could set up and erect a very myopic, narrow worldview called white supremacy that imagines that there is just this one force that has shaped our world and created a world in which whiteness is enriched with all privilege and blackness is less than human. When I looked at those top 25 universities, the other thing that I was startled to find was that white people are not the majority on any of those campuses. And at the University of Maryland, they're actually at 13%. In medical schools, interestingly, if you are to apply to a medical school, do you think your chances of getting in as a black student with exactly the same GPA as a white student, a Latino student, and an Asian student are higher or lower? What would you guess based on what you've heard about implicit bias and all of these other studies that are supposed to very clearly and obviously demonstrate that black students are discriminated against at every turn? It's somewhere close to 80%. 80% higher in certain quartiles for students with average grades who are applying to exactly the same medical school. Universities are doing everything that they can to try and create environments that are identical in terms of the demographic representation of students on their campuses to the world that they live in. There may, in fact, be unintended consequences to a program like that. Is a student who goes to a university that they may, in fact, not be prepared for because the university has a different set of standards for them going to be better off if they take 2 years of school, accumulate debt, and don't finish? I'm not sure about that. Is a student going to be better off if they, as Mr. Ross has suggested, if they were to go to a historically black college or university, it might not be as good as another school that they could have gotten into. Are they better off? Are they better off going to a school on the basis of their racial identity so that they can be in a monolithic environment that looks nothing like the world that they will inhabit? I suppose you might be better off if you are someone who decides that you are an affirmatively black person. But for whatever reason, we are in an era when there are people like Richard Spencer who are hosting events and unfortunately getting far more attention than they deserve or warrant. But there is something good that Richard Spencer does. Every now and again, he'll go on and he'll talk about white pride and whiteness and his heritage and how much he loves and appreciates his whiteness. You've even had a student who tried to found a white student union on their campus. For whatever reason, when we encounter tribalism, like just base, gross tribalism on college campuses in the form of white pride, we recognize it for the guttural instinct that it is, something that we should all be trying to striving to rise above. But we make odd exceptions in our society. When Barack Obama shows up at Howard University to give his to give a commencement speech, he encourages this entire sea of young people to be confident in their blackness. He, of course, goes on to say that there is no one right way to be black. But what that suggests to me is that if there is a universe of blackness, an infinite sea of it, and you can be anything, then perhaps it doesn't mean anything at all. Perhaps it's sufficiently arbitrary that you could set it aside and not revel in it. Perhaps it's sufficiently arbitrary that we can find ways to build bridges between communities on campus, to learn to identify with one another in any number of important ways that are distinct, but not just our appearances. And perhaps the trends and the patterns that we see when students join any number of different organizations that are primarily interested in their race, that are primarily interested in highlighting the things that make them different one another, perhaps those things aren't necessarily going to produce the sort of outcomes that we want. In much the same way that the diversity programs that have been created, as studies have shown over and over again, haven't really done a great deal to improve the conditions of the various organizations that they're supposed to improve. Instead, what they usually do is make the folks that are involved in those diversity programs feel terrible about themselves, hiring managers, and even folks on campus. So at any rate, I think I've exhausted my time. So
you want to wrap up?
I wrapped it up. No, I yield the floor.
Okay. All right. Took a little less than 15 minutes. But, thank you. Five minutes of rebuttal from the affirmative. Take it away, Lawrence.
I think my first question would be, I think there's kind of a misnomer that you have to, as an African-American, you have to make a choice between going to historically black college university, by the way, which were established as part of, as a response to white supremacy, because African-Americans weren't allowed to many, not all, predominantly white institutions. African-American students should be able to go to the Berkeleys of the world, UCLA's, I see Go Bears right there. We should be able to go to a state school that is in our state. We should be able to go to a private university. We should be able to go to historically black college university. My son is going to next fall going to an art school because he is an artist. But there is at no point in time should we think to ourselves that racism on a college campus is something that should be acceptable or a hurdle that black students that should have to deal with on their own. And I reject this idea that simply because college universities kind of make the mitigating effort to create diversity and inclusion. And for many years, they had diversity offices, but not inclusion offices, which really meant that a lot of African-American students had a transitory experience on college campuses. They would come, they would feel like, yeah, this is an educational Disneyland, but by the time they got to their senior year, they thought to themselves, well, the last thing I'll do is I'll give money back to this university because I don't feel a part of it. But we don't have to make that choice. We African-American students shouldn't have to make that choice. And a lot of times what happens is that universities, in terms of how they look toward African-American students, that's just a canary in the coal mine. Typically, when we look, for example, we go a little bit deeper, we have this diversity and inclusion area, which we, of course, naturally say are for the students of color, even though really it's for pretty much any student on campus. But we also should look at the fact that when we talk about faculty on college campuses, even though it's been a record number of African Americans getting PhDs all in the last 10, 20 years or so, the rate of African American faculty on college campuses has remained at the high around around 6.8% for at Emory to a 2.7 at my alma mater at Berkeley. So you don't even have African American faculty on these college campuses. So when you look at all those in totality, you can't just simply just say, well, you know, maybe they shouldn't be going to these schools. And I reject this idea that every or even most African-American students who are coming on predominantly white institutions are either unqualified or not qualified and shouldn't be there or suddenly should be at some other school. Some should. Hey, that's pretty much any person who comes on a college campus. Sometimes kids come on college campuses and they find that the rigor of the school is too much for them. But by pointing out African-American students, no. But the real, going back to the resolution, when we talk about the resolution itself, we're talking about whether or not the university is a hostile space. And you don't have to do the leap to say, well, is it as hostile as it was in, you know, the 1950s or 1960s? Of course not. You know, white supremacy, when we talk about white supremacy, is not some type of static thing where we're talking about, well, it just remains the same. So we have the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 2017, it's the exact same. No, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is we have not attacked the very things that happen in society before our kids actually even get on the college campus. We haven't attacked those aspects of white supremacy. So why would we expect that when we talk about institutional and systemic and individual racism, why would we suspect that they would not face that institutional, systemic, and institutional racism on a college campus if that they exist in American society anyway? It makes no sense. And therefore, what you have, again, are university presidents playing a game of racism whack-a-mole where they're more interested. In 2015, University of Pennsylvania did a study where they found that they studied the reactions from university presidents when it came to reacting to campus racist incidents. And what they found was that campus presidents were basically doing PR for the university. They would condemn the individual incident and say, you know, this does not, for example, University of Oklahoma, David Boren would say, this does not reflect the Sooner family. This does not reflect the Sooner family and what we believe in, and these bigots do not reflect it. But what David Boren didn't talk about is that 2 months prior to the incident happening, the black students had met with him and talked about they did not feel part of the Sooner family, that they did not feel intricately part of it, and they had formed an organization called OU Unheard to talk about as we as black students do not feel heard. So it's important for when we talk about these things is to say, look, we got to get out the idea that these spaces are somehow, because they're starting to address the needs of African-American students or students of color in general, that they've done a good job doing that, or just the remedy itself, or one of the remedies themselves, is somehow dividing up students. No. These students and faculty and administrators are coming to the campuses with the same things they had outside the campus than when they arrive.
Thank you, Lawrence. 5 minutes of rebuttal from the negative. Take it away, Camille.
I would quibble with a few of the characterizations there, but I am not defending a proposition here. You are. And quite frankly, I think that the most damning evidence really is the survey data. The survey data wherein black students, 68% of which responded to a question about the nature of race relations on their campus and said that they thought that they were good or excellent. In another survey, this is the Knight Foundation survey from the Newseum Foundation, 74% of all students said that they thought that race relations on campus were good or excellent. It seems to me that there is a very significant problem trying to make this argument that these campuses are hostile spaces. There is certainly an expectation among some of these students, as I've mentioned, which is a point in your favor perhaps, that on other campuses things are bad. But on their own campuses, they simply don't see that problem, which suggests to me that perhaps they believe they will encounter these things. Perhaps there is a predisposition to believe this for whatever reason. But it also suggests that they might not be seeing these events happen. I didn't dismiss all of the things that happened. I certainly didn't suggest that racism on campus isn't being addressed. Quite the contrary, there are response units that have been spun up and placed on various campuses to try and address these issues. The question is whether or not those response units are having the sort of impact that one would hope they would have. And I don't know that it's enough to say that it's just PR when you respond to a situation on campus wherein one of the people on your campus has done something that is disrespectful, that is racist, that embarrasses the rest of the folks on your campus. But one thing you haven't spoken to are the numerous cases, and I say numerous because there's certainly more than one. We've had one in the last week where there is either no one found, and it's suspicious as to whether or not anything actually transpired here in terms of a hate crime, or where is it actually a fraudulent hate crime. And the fact that we are actually seeing, as I mentioned, a reduction in the total number of hate crimes, and there are in fact these fake hate crimes taking place, that one of the events that you mentioned is a sit-in, a three-day sit-in at Colgate University because of text messages sent on an anonymous messaging service. Anonymous messaging service. I don't even know if these are students, let alone white people who actually hate black students. It seems to me that it is incredibly easy to make the argument that the specter of racism is everywhere. It's also incredibly easy to substantiate that claim if all you have to do is find something that doesn't quite seem right to you and say, well, there it is right there. You also mentioned University of Maryland in your book, and I want to bring it up because, again, my alma mater, Byrd Stadium, which the time I was there is just Byrd Stadium. I went to games there. I was not aware of the history of the man for whom the stadium is named. But in not being aware, it caused me no great injury. And one wonders if several years after I've matriculated, a student decides, well, I'm going to campaign against this. I'm going to crusade against this. I'm going to send letters to incoming athletes to let them know that they are playing on a racist field. This isn't a racist field. Perhaps a building has the name of someone unsavory on it. And we've certainly seen situations like that. And I think that some of your better evidence, so you may want to address that, but I'll preempt it by saying that when a university makes a determination to keep the name of a building the same and decides that, as opposed to taking off the name of this person who has done disreputable things, in some cases participated in lynchings, multiple lynchings, and talked about doing so with pride, and they decide that they're going to put a plaque on that building, not to commemorate this person, but to underscore the wrong that was done. If you don't like that outcome, that's not racist. If you don't like that outcome, you're dissatisfied. And given the number of people in this room, I suspect we all have differences of opinions on whether or not that is a good and virtuous way to adjudicate the problem.
Thank you, Camille. Now we have, before we put it open to questions from the audience, we have 5 minutes in which each side gets to ask the other one question. Camille, is there a question you'd like to put to Lawrence?
I'd love to hear you address both the survey data, actually primarily just the survey data.
Okay, so survey data, I haven't studied it, so I have no idea. You know, I can give you another survey and I can say, well, you know, this, I have no idea. But I would also say that I would treat the survey kind of like how Americans treat their Congress people. They're overall basically, you know, dissatisfied with Congress, but they love their own particular congressperson. I don't know in terms of the amount of people or who did the actual surveying, when they did the survey, or who talked to them about the survey. However, really, I think you actually said something in your statement about University of Maryland. That is true. As an individual, it is quite possible to walk around campus and not study the buildings on which you're on the campus. You can be blithely walking through. There's not a problem with that, and you will not be harmed. But at the same time, the fact that there are buildings there that supposedly named after people that represent the values of a college or university, you would think that if you had a college that did actually understand what those buildings were named after, that they would say, this may have meant something in the 1920s, 30s, or 40s, or 50s. For example, Kamel was talking about Byrd Stadium. Byrd Stadium is named after a man named Harry Curly Byrd. Harry Curly Byrd, who went from being the college football coach to the president of the university. I do not know about that track. But he had at one point in time denied an African-American athlete from Syracuse to play. Now, it's a little thing. Again, you can go to the University of Maryland and have a wonderful time as an African American. But once you understand that knowledge, you might want to actually then say, well, perhaps this is not the honor that this person deserves. Now, I just want to make one last point. We typically look at those things and we say to ourselves, well, you know, what does it matter about the names on the buildings? Now, when we talk about, for example, University of Munich. If the University of Munich had statues or buildings named after members of the Nazi Party, and asked Jewish students to walk on that campus and to ignore it, yes, some students may ignore it, but other people may be offended. And that's the point. We ask African-American students to ignore it. Some will not have any type of issue with it if they do not know. But once you do know, you then typically want to do something to change it because you think University of Maryland is your campus.
Thank you, Lawrence. And is there a question you can put, you'd like to put to Camille?
Oh, let's see. The one big thing I talk about, you say hate crimes, and this is kind of where I talk about in terms of, you know, making racism kind of like elevated to where it's kind of it's hard to hit that metric. And you talked about Yik Yak. I'm trying to do this. You know, I'm trying to find out what level of racism do you find to not be insignificant?
I don't know that I would attach a percentage to that. I will say that we don't live in the New Jerusalem. We live here on Earth. And here on Earth, with utopia not being an option, there was going to be some level of crime and violence and man's inhumanity to man. It's worth noting that some of those hate crimes are perpetrated by black people as well. Some of those hate crimes are almost certainly aimed at white people and various other racial groups. My expectation is not that I can eviscerate all racism. So since I don't set that as a goal, I won't pretend that I'm not pleased when there are fewer hate crimes taking place. Right, I think that is a good outcome.
Yeah, yeah.
I also think it's appropriate to note that when you have black students matriculating on campuses, when you have the model minority in this country in terms of attending school based on the size of their population, being African immigrants and West Indian immigrants to this country, it is very difficult for me to accept the argument that we live in a country that is so steeped in racism and animosity, both sort of secret and inadvertent and unintentional, that black people simply cannot be successful in this country, or that they are in a position where it makes sense to carry this sort of chip on your shoulder that suggests that when in fact you see events happen someplace in the world that seem to fit a particular narrative, i.e., we could talk about police shootings, for example. Ferguson is actually an interesting example of this. You hear a story about a police officer shooting a young man, and you immediately jump to the conclusion that a crime was committed. Do we have to wait for the facts to come out? And when the facts do come out, do we embrace the truth, or do we stick with the narrative that's established? And when I say truth, in this particular case, I'm talking about several independent investigations that lead to a particular outcome. Now, I'm not making that argument because I don't think that there aren't a significant number of issues with respect to police violence aimed at civilians. I'm actually making it for the opposite reason. My big concern has been that big concern has been that the Black Lives Matter movement has in fact created an environment wherein it is harder to achieve reforms by focusing primarily on the motivations of police who find themselves in violent encounters with citizens rather than the facts, the why, the things that we might actually be able to mitigate through law in order to achieve change. I think that if we know that, for example, ending the drug war is likely to create a situation in which there are less encounters with police, that is perhaps the principal thing that we should be talking about, rather than imagining a set of circumstances and creating a narrative and establishing it as fact, regardless of what the actual facts are.
We just mentioned Ferguson and the drug war, and all interesting, a little bit beyond, but sort of relevant to the universities. Thank you for that, Camille. Well, before we throw it open to questions, I just want to take moderator's prerogative to hone in on an issue that has been raised. Camille, what would you say to state to defend the idea that the survey data you cited, you said 65% of black students say good to okay to excellent, 70% good to excellent. When were these studies taken? What can you say about the legitimacy of the information
sure.
that you're citing?
Sure. Well, these are two separate surveys, both of which were taken in the last 24 months. One was early 2016. To mid-2016, the other was 2015 to 2016, if I'm not mistaken. Both of these are supposed to be representative samples. The Knight Foundation survey was, I believe, well over 6,000 students. And I don't remember the number for the other survey, but what leads me to believe that these are likely trustworthy surveys is that the numbers were pretty close to one another, both in terms of the magnitudes and the trends. I don't think anyone would quibble with the survey's indication that students on college campuses are concerned about these issues, that students on college campuses simultaneously believe that their campus is safe and good because they're there and they see it, and they also believe that somewhere out there, all of the terrible things that they're hearing about are in fact taking place. They are not ignoring racial injustice. They're not ignoring the situation that is supposed to exist wherein black people are being taken advantage of or black people are subjugated by forces that are always at work in our society, whether or not people are willfully racist. They are deeply concerned about it, perhaps more concerned than they ought to be.
Lawrence, before we throw it up to questions, do you want to comment on that response?
A couple of things. When we talk about you made a statement talking about why would African Americans be going to these schools if they're if the schools themselves are racist? African Americans have never been stopped by the idea of racism on college campuses. African Americans have been going to college campuses since Oberlin College in 1820. Through the days of slavery, Berea College in Kentucky was in 1850. African Americans were on those college campuses through slavery. The idea of college being a transformational place educationally, economically and socially, has always been important for African Americans. So the idea of having to trudge through the racism at the same time in order to get that education, it's been something that is not a deterrent, but it does not mean that they have to have that extra burden on top of it. It's the exact same reason why if we have a campus that is a misogynist campus, you shouldn't have that extra burden for women in terms of gender. It's what we're talking about is whether or not, in terms of the resolution, is whether or not universities are hostile spaces for African Americans. And I'm still trying to, Black Lives Matter, okay, that's fine. But when we talk about in terms of the space of college campuses, again, I don't know anything about the survey, so I can't speak to that. But what I can say is that it's not African American students. You can't have just 200 different African American college campuses, predominantly white institutions. You cannot have 200 campuses erupt in campus protests and suddenly think that these are black students who are thinking that this is happening somewhere else. Even at Berkeley, I love my school, University of California, Berkeley, where we protest Tuesday for not being Thursday. But you still cannot look around and say, and also what happens is that when something happens at a UCLA, people then become introspective about what is going on at their own particular campus. It kind of goes back to what Camille had said about University of Maryland. He had gone through and got his degree and everything. That's fine at University of Maryland and had no problem with Byrd Stadium. But guess what? When you actually turn around and someone at another campus is talking about, Ben Tillman Hall, you begin to look at yourself and say, wait a second, I heard about this and maybe we should not have this on our campus.
All right. Thank you, Lawrence. Okay. Questions, please. Phrase your question as a question. If you want to talk to the speakers later, you'll have ample opportunity. Please ask your question.
So let's just say there is some sort of inherent bias that comes around in nature from before when kids go to college that they have when they come into college. Don't you think one of the things, or maybe even a leading factor, that might be contributing to this this sort of quote-unquote hostile space is this focus in racial studies classes and gender studies classes on trigger warnings, safe spaces, microaggressions. Something I say that you maybe disagree with turns into hate speech, turns into that's violent and racist against me. Wouldn't you say that this environment, or what do you think about this environment that's constantly having everybody focus on race, even at the most unintentional levels of me asking, where are you from? And saying, you have now aggressed me, you have now offended me, you are now racist for asking me this. Don't you say that there is, that could be a contributing factor, or maybe even a leading contributing factor to this?
It's addressed to you, Lance. Answer the question.
I reject that. I mean, I think what happens is that Americans tend to create experiments in terms of trying to figure out how to mitigate. We recognize that the space itself is hostile. So what we have to do is we have to try to figure out what are going to be the things that we're going to do in terms of creating different policies in order to try to mitigate this hostility. Now, are they perfect? Of course not. You know, I'm from the free speech movement campus. I believe in free speech. And so what happens is that people test things out and then they don't work and they test something else out, but they are thinking about it. It's like Winston Churchill once said, Americans would always do the right thing after they tried everything else. And when on a college campus, that's exactly what they're doing. But it's also important to recognize that we're not just all of a sudden, you know, talking all the time about race. This is suddenly, instead of being a monologue, it's starting to be a dialogue. And suddenly students of color are starting to speak up and people are going to have to then listen to what are their particular perspectives. And going back to what I was talking about in terms of by the time students get to college, they come from segregated communities. They're coming from, this is a little bit beyond the scope, but Latinos are coming from 80% segregation from K to 12 and 43% intense segregation, meaning that less than 10% of their student body in K to 12 are white students, and African Americans are around 74 and 38%. So this is really the first time they're actually starting to talk to each other, and they're bringing different experiences. And yes, you have the hyperbolic issues where, you know, some student learns something in ethnic studies class and they're hyperbolic about it. Well, they're college students. They're going to be hyperbolic about things, okay? So, but the issue is, how do you, you know, do your dialogue in order to learn from each other? And what happens is that when you learn and it's a dialogue and you don't retreat and you come back and yeah, it may be a tough conversation, but when you do that, then what happens is that you make that space a little less hostile for the next generation. When I'm in the affirmative for this, it doesn't mean a permanent state of hostility. I told you, it's not a permanent state of hostility. It is what it is right now. Deconstruct it, then it will be less for the next generation.
You want to comment, Camille?
Only briefly. You know, one thing that I've noticed about just the historical trend, and I'm going back now because we seem to be having a conversation in which, you know, we established that the United States has done that awful and terrible things have happened here. We sort of continue on and we get to campuses. And part of the reason why the campus environment is bad is because other bad things have happened here. It's just there is a sea of racism. In fact, I believe in the opening of your book, you describe the existence of black students on college campuses as swimming through a sea of feces. Stronger language. Figurative language. That is gross. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I mean, for sure. To the extent that's the case, however, and I'm sort of reminded of James Baldwin here, who, I mean, when you were quoting him earlier, I wanted you to finish because I love to hear him because he's so lyrical. But when he talks about the fact that for black people, whites have always been a problem, that there's always been this danger. He says to them, and this isn't the fire next time, that they should be careful that the gates of paranoia do not close on them, so that they find themselves in a situation where they are both responding to things that they imagine are happening to them and things that are in fact happening to them, and that they lose the ability to tell the difference between the two. I think that was a bit of a Jeremiad, and not only a warning for white people to stop doing things, but also to black people to be aware of the consequences of living in a situation like this. And quite frankly, I can't say that when I look at the difference between sort of Rosa Parks and Tawana Brawley in terms of the eras that I think we live in, the epochs, and that's not an arbitrary distinction. I think that it's important to note that we're in the era of the Duke Lacrosse case.
You on?
Yeah, we're in the era of the Duke Lacrosse case. That's what happened.
Duke Lacrosse. Next question. Thank you for the question.
Okay, so this question is for Camille that I'd like you to respond to. So when I first read the prompt, my immediate response was to think, that's absurd. Every college in the U.S. obsesses over avoiding the slightest hint of racism, right? But then I looked at the question from a different angle. Black students show up to college, and the first thing they hear is they live in a country that is virulently racist. Their fellow students will deem them undeserving because of the color of their skin. They'll be the last to be promoted at their first job at their college, and when they are promoted, they'll make less than their white peers. Racism pervades essentially every interaction between whites and blacks. So it's this imaginary conception of the world created by the left and pervasive on college campuses that consumes black students. It affects the decisions. Why study a high-paying field like accounting, engineering, or law when the deck is stacked against you? And it's this anti-racist environment that becomes toxic, in a sense racist, and halts the progress and advancements of many blacks in this country.
It's possible. I don't know. I mean, when I comment on stuff publicly, I do my best to try and qualify them. If I feel a pretty high degree of confidence, I'll say so. My suspicion is that that may be part of the issue.
Could you repeat the question?
repeat the entire question? The gist of the question, I believe, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is that for black students, when they arrive on college campuses, they are effectively indoctrinated into a set of beliefs about the world that they are getting ready to inherit in going to a university and becoming a leader, that they are going to face discrimination in many places, that they're not going to earn as much as their white peers, et cetera, et cetera. That in fact, white supremacy is in fact the rule of the land. It rules over all of our lives, and it prevents us from accomplishing various things, or at least being as successful as we could possibly be, unless we're twice as good. I don't think it's possible to actually believe that about the world. To actually believe that most people you meet are having some sort of automatic response to you and your blackness, and that's the first thing that they're thinking about, and to not be incredibly self-conscious, and to not have it create sort of a sense of dread and existential crisis. And it doesn't, in fact, surprise me that when things happen, be they small or large, it's exactly what I expected. We are pattern-seeking animals. Once we have a narrative in mind, we will find it. We will find it, and we will find it again. And as soon as we find it, we will scream loudly that we've done so, and insist that you people should have been paying attention all along.
Lawrence, would you like to comment?
Yeah, of course. I didn't travel from Los Angeles in that comment. I always like those empty vessel black people who are just waiting to be manipulated by the left. I'm not really, to tell you honestly, worried about left or right college campuses. I really don't care, you know. But I do care about one thing in terms of like that imaginary black student who is going to be indoctrinated about, you know, white supremacy, so on and so forth. Remember, I've been telling you about the 74% of African Americans from K-12 go to a segregated school, 38%. Now that number is just, you know, what the heck does that mean, you know, over the long period of time? Because there's nothing inferior about going to a, you know, segregated school from K-12. Unless for every 10% rise in the amount of students of color at your school, there's a $75 decrease in the amount of funding. Okay? So these students aren't walking into these college campuses not understanding, oh, by the way, four times as likely to go to a school where their teachers are not as qualified. 80% of their teachers not qualified. They're not getting on college campuses sitting up here thinking, oh my God, you know, racism is going to kill me. They're thinking about, oh, I must be a superhuman person for having overcome a segregated school in my inner city neighborhood in order to get on that college campus. And how can I make as much money as possible in order to not have as much student debt? They're as rational as anyone else. The fact that they are sitting there having, as that young woman from the University of Oklahoma talked about, is she said, I came on here to be an engineer, not to be a majoring in campus protests. Most African-American students, when they arrive on campus, want to be like Kamel. Don't want to, you know, I mean, and me too, I'm not trying to put it on you. Just want to go to school and get a degree. Go to school, get a degree, have no debt to Sallie Mae, and walk off into the sunset. But what happens oftentimes is that when we're getting on these college campuses, and I hear these students over and over talk about it, is that they're being prevented. Not being prevented from doing it. Not being prevented from getting the degree, but being prevented from having the holistic experience of going to a college university and saying, you know something, this university really wants me here. And I'm, again, my definition of the university is not just simply the administration or diversity inclusion, but the students who are here, the faculty who are here, the administrators, the everything, the elements of college university. So I honestly, and I don't have to put you on the spot because I know you asked the question, and I'm very happy about you doing that, but the imaginary African-American who is just in a whirlwind because they got on campus and they're being indoctrinated by all these bad ideas about fighting people who want to demean them as human beings makes no sense. It's the most rational thing in the world. When people, if you feel, and you're coming from a segregated society, if you're getting on a college campus and you feel that, you know something, I'm coming to college not just for a check or a job, I'm coming to help transform society, well, then you educate yourself and you do that as soon as possible.
Thank you, Lawrence. Next question.
Just a really quick statement. I feel like all the points or that you've laid out with regard to the our country's segregated school systems, they're all perfect arguments for school choice reform. Now, that being said, so, all right, in any important discussion, it is paramount that you define your terms, correct? Now, also, I guess that's due to the subjectivity of the resolution here. Now, there are two definitions, in my estimation, that are making the rounds in common parlance of racism. There's the one that seems more ubiquitous to me, which is predicated based on any sort of racial animus. And then there's another that seems more popular and is being promulgated on college campuses, which seeks to make racism more an entity, something that is more geared towards power, power plus prejudice, I guess, is the more succinct way to put it. Now, this question is to the two of you. Which of these definitions seems more suitable to the two of you? One, to me, seems to rob African Americans of their agency and see them and paint them as will-less actors without autonomy, that they're completely subject to the will of the whites around them. The other seems more, I guess, universal.
I'll go first. I'm trying to think. You had two different aspects you were saying in terms of looking at racism as racist plus power. And what was your one, the first?
The other was the more ubiquitous.
Well, like individual racism, I guess.
It was the more ubiquitous use to me is that any sort of racial animus, any idea that one is genetically better than another race.
Yeah, okay. So, okay. Thank you very much for your question. I think you have like anything in terms of, you know, some, you know, absurdisms, like racism is absurdism. You have various aspects in all that. You have, for example, you know, your overt, you know, your David Duke cliche versions of, you know, racist and the Nazi who puts a swastika on their forehead and they, you know, declare themselves better than everyone. You know, you have those elements of racism. But I think those races, those are easily dealt with. I think what we're talking about in terms of the second one is not necessarily this idea, this is not some Calvinist type of, idea, that is predetermined because we live in a society that is, that has racism plus power that you can't fight against it. One beautiful thing about the redemptive nature of America, and I say this about the kryptonite of against white supremacy, is the idea that we actually do believe in our principles and ideas. We do. I mean, that's kind of our yin yang. We've always had, at the same time as at the time that we had racism plus power, we still believe in the ideal that a young man named Barack Obama can be the president of the United States, and he was. Now, you can't get that, and I will argue this, and I don't have anything, quantitatively to say about this, but I'll just put this out there that you can't get that. Barack Obama could not have been president of the United States without having gone to one of these so-called, hostile spaces called, getting higher education. Donald Trump could have, without going to there, but, that's another thing. But I think you can have those two dual things happening at the same time. You can fight the overt cliche of the racist in terms of white supremacist groups, and some of them, by the way, who are now starting to come on campus with overt calls for white supremacy, and at the same time recognize that you live in a society that is unequal based upon race. You can do that. You can fight those two fights, and I honestly don't think Camille and I actually will disagree. Maybe I will, but I don't think you can have those. That's not a problem doing both.
Thank you, Lawrence. Camille, you want to comment?
Sure. I think at the beginning of the conversation, I tried to at least create some sort of demarcation. When I am using the word racism and we're talking about it in this context, I'm thinking about explicit acts that are aimed at degrading someone, or actual prohibitions against black people or various other racial groups doing things that are codified in the law. I think that is pretty easy to call and to describe as racist. There is a subjectivity to racism in virtually every other context. And the popular definition about racism requiring power, I've always found extremely dissatisfactory. Quite frankly, today, in an environment where you could potentially lose your job for using the word niggardly because it sounds like nigger, the real question is who, in fact, has power in that sort of dynamic. There is no doubt that there are certain people who feel empowered to speak freely about issues of race. I feel fine saying just about anything about race. most of you wouldn't take this microphone and do that. You would actually take a few seconds to ponder whether or not this is the right thing to say. In fact, those implicit bias association tests, the ones that we had sort of, we know that this is true. I mean, we have these tests that can test it and tell you. Earlier this year, a massive meta study that surveyed a bunch of these results, calls into question whether or not those things are trustworthy. And part of the reason is if I show you a picture of a black family like eating cake at a picnic, your score will rise if you just see that before you take the test. And the other thing is, from my standpoint, when I look at the results, and what these studies are generally taking a look at is whether or not it takes you longer to respond when you see, say, a picture of a black family or a picture of a white family, if it takes you longer to respond to the prompts. If I see a black family flash up on the screen and I'm a white guy, and I've been conditioned as a consequence of living in a society in which our speech is so policed that there are various ways in which I can and cannot talk about race without potentially losing my friends, or potentially losing my job, or maybe just someone will presume I'm kind of a racist, I'm going to take a little bit longer to answer that question.
Yeah, as you should.
Okay. We're running out of time. Yeah, next question. Can I have the young lady come up, please, and ask your question? Go ahead.
Thanks for coming, guys. Thanks very much. My question is also sort of about definitions, just clarification. So you both brought up, you both questioned a definition within the resolution. And you both didn't answer each other's point. And each point you could write a dissertation on, but I'm going to ask you to try and address it as succinctly as you can. So Camille, Lawrence, I think, brought up, he questioned environment. About the distinction between colleges and the rest of the United States. And Lawrence, Camille brought up, questioned the definition of race, or maybe just, I don't know, might have just been specifically blackness, about the subjectivity of identifying within a race, within a racial construct. So if possible, within the time frame we have, I'd love for you guys to address each other's points.
Guys, this is going to have to be the last question. Those who are still online, sorry. But please, of course, do come up and buttonhole these guys afterwards. I think you understood the question, Camille?
I'm not sure I did.
Okay, repeat the question, then give the young lady back the mic.
So I'm reiterating Lawrence's point here, but he Camille. Questioned the definition of environment within the resolution. So he was saying that there is okay, less understood. Of a distinction just for the audience, between campus and the rest of the United States.
I don't know that there is a significant difference between campus and the United States. I would say that campuses are in the United States. Campuses are shaped by myriad forces. I think the challenge that I would, or the objection that I would level, is not specifically about the argument about campuses being these uniquely racist places. It's the force that is supposedly making them uniquely racist, which is that race has played this this incredibly important role in helping to shape our society and helping to produce the outcomes that we have today, in influencing the perspectives that we have about various issues. There's a sense in which that's true. I mean, it's necessarily true. Things happen. And as a consequence, there are repercussions. There are ripple effects. But lots of things have happened in this country. A great many things. In fact, some of those things have been quite good. And it's difficult for me to accept an argument that squeezes the aperture when we look back at the past and only sees this thing as the force that is the current that is shaping society going forward. It certainly has consequences, but there are other factors that matter as well. We've had any number of programs created that were supposed to ameliorate generations of poverty and make things better. Whether or not those programs made things better or worse is an important question that we ought to be asking. Even the drug war, second time I'm mentioning it, there may be a reason, but even the drug war is something that in black communities in the 1970s, during the first heroin epidemic, they were upset that there weren't more cops in their neighborhoods. They were upset that there weren't stiffer penalties for people who were dealing drugs. The crack and powder cocaine laws that came into place, those disparities, the ones that people generally regard today as racist, we actually call it that, were created out of a motivation to try to do something about this bad situation that we saw before. So lots of forces have shaped the world that we live in. Lots of forces have shaped the campuses. And I don't think it makes a hell of a lot of sense to sort of separate the two from one another.
Okay, I just want to make sure I get your... I'm sorry. I know we've had you repeat it three times. You talk about it was a racial construct of subjectivity. And I just... Was there any more? Did you have anything?
No, I was just saying that race... I mean, my general claim is that race is a social construct.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And, now I got it. And that it is subjective and we can jettison...
Beautiful. Okay. I just want to make sure I was correct. Okay. So, yes. Look, when we talk about race, a lot of times what we say is, you know, race is a biological nothing. There's nothing in this room separating us from in DNA. Nothing. But it's a social, you know, sociological something. The reason why when we talk about white supremacy and then we talk about the racial caste system that comes from it is because we don't. I'm not from black land. You know, I'm an African American, but the in terms of how the racial construct in which we create, it means something. But there are a lot of social constructs in this world that actually mean something. Money is a social construct. And if you guys want to give me all your non-essential, you know, non-important money because you don't believe in it, feel free to buy a book over there. But it's important for us to not get confused. we can at the same time say fight for this ideal that we want to make race and racism something that is in the past. We do. Every generation wants to do that. But we also have the realities of saying we do know what is here right now. No one, and you were absolutely, Camille's absolutely right. How we look at race and how we deal with policies change over time. We learn, we make mistakes, we have priorities at one particular point in time that change in the future. And that's the same thing that happens on college campuses. The priorities of the 1960s are different than the priorities of 2017. Does not mean for the 2017 student, African-American student, who walks on a college campus that they don't see a hostile space. They may not have the same experience that I had in mid-1980s. They might not have the same experience of a person, my grandparents, or so forth in the mid-1960s. But in terms of the construct, in terms of how they see race on a college campus, they see it through their own eyes and they see their own sense of reality. And that racial construct, yes, it may be a social construct that we created as Americans, but we created it. And if we created it, then we're going to have to figure out ways to actually get rid of it.
Thank you. That concludes the questions. Thanks very much. And again, you'll have the opportunity to put another. Think about how you're going to vote for the resolution as you listen to the summations. Lawrence, you have 5 minutes to summarize your point of view. Please take it away, Lawrence.
When I began here talking about one incident at the University of Oklahoma about two white students singing about a very crude song. And then I talked about going back to 1963 and talking about some other students, Tau Kappa Epsilon, at Cal State Long Beach singing another cruel song. The point of it wasn't to be provocative. That wasn't the point. And the point wasn't to say that all white students or all faculty or all white administrators hate African-American students on college campuses. That's not what I'm saying. But what I did want you to understand is that when African-American students go on college campuses, they're going there for the exact same reason as any other student. They do not want to go on a college campus and they have and have to deal with the same issues that are going on in society. Really, they really do. African-American students really do believe in that educational Disneyland. They believe when that fifth grade teacher told them because they won the spelling bee that they were going to college, and that mythical space of college was a place where they could transform their lives and now also their families' lives. But when we look at the plurality of the racism incidents that occur on college campuses, you can't look at them and say, well, they're just all isolated incidents. You cannot look in the face of African-American students who are being demeaned and say, well, you should just basically just get over it. You can't think to yourself that we live in a country where a certain segment of our universities are actively trying to tell African-American students that you don't belong there. And if we want to look at it from the standpoint of race and racism, then we would think to ourselves, well, what's a counterfactual? What about what happens at the 105 historically black college and universities? If racism, in terms of how we look at it, is something that, you know, we say, well, is it inevitable place, an inevitable thing on college campuses, which I do say on predominantly white institutions, well, then the 21% of the white students who go to historically black college and universities would face the same thing if they don't. Not a single, I looked for 60 years and not a single incident of African-American students treating white students on historically black college and universities the way African-American students are being treated on predominantly white institutions. And that's a problem. And it's a bigger problem if we look around ourselves and we think of our kids who we send to these schools and we think of them as being good moral people who are non-racist, but we don't ask them to be anti-racist. If you're going to be a person who is going to change society versus a person who is just getting a degree for it to be a job, you have to go and be anti. You have to be active. And the point I came here for coming to this debate was simply actually for that message. It is important for our white students and white faculty and white administrators to create that utopian universe that we all talk about at college being as soon as possible.
Thank you very much for bringing me.
Thank you, Lawrence. Camille. 5 minutes for Camille to summarize his point of view, negating the resolution. Take it away.
I want to zoom in on one of the claims that was just made, that there are universities that are actively telling black students that they don't care about them, that they aren't fully people. That isn't a thing. There is no university in America that is doing that. Not a single one. I feel very good about saying that unequivocally. In fact, it's quite the contrary. Universities are spending tens of millions of dollars, in some cases, on programs explicitly designed to bring black students to their campuses. They are investing in and creating units on their campus to take care of the special needs of the students on those campuses. And this year, at Harvard, graduate students decided to host their own African-American-only black graduation, in addition to their regular graduation. 2017. What on earth are you doing? Like, that seems like a step backwards. That doesn't seem like progress. And they didn't create this in response to some specific event. They created it in order to deal with, as I remember it, in order to try to give themselves and their unique black experience sort of an opportunity to walk the stage together, because only they could understand one another. It's possible. It's possible that there is just a uniformity of thought and a uniformity of experience, and that they are being subjected to all manner of subtextual and explicit racism that means the only thing one can do is come together to overcome it. But I'm looking for the data to support that, and I haven't seen it. What I've seen instead is the U.S. medical school acceptance rates from 2013 to 2016 for someone aged 27 to 29. And if you've got a 3.4 GPA to a 3.59 GPA, and you are Asian, 20.6%, and you are white, 29%. If you are Hispanic, 59.5%. If you are black, 81.2%. They want you desperately. Where is the campus where they're saying, get out of here? If the response to a racist event on campus occurring, or an occurrence of supposed racism, be it real or imagined, and very recently we had an imagined one, it was actually contrived. If the chancellor of the school shows up on television and he asserts that this is not who we are, the notion that that can both be evidence of an effort to undermine black people on campus and somehow an effort to try and paper over these bad occurrences on campus just to save face, I just don't understand that. I think that the two things are at complete odds with one another. The case simply has not been made here today with anything more than assertion and anecdote that America's campuses are hostile towards black students in general, in particular, or even as a matter of happenstance. Just hasn't.
Okay, that closes the debate. Thank you, Camille. All
right.
All right. Guys, stick around. Okay. All right. Please vote again. America's colleges have fostered a racist environment that makes them a hostile space for African-American students. Yes, no, or undecided. While you're deliberating, let me again announce that next month I'll be debating Adam Smith with Mark Skousen. In July, we will be having a debate on school choice. We are going to take off the month of August. In September, we have a debate scheduled on Medicare. At the moment, October is to be announced. In November, we have a debate scheduled on free trade. And anybody who has ideas for debates, love to hear about them. Let's talk about it later. Anybody who wants to talk to our debaters afterwards, they'll be available. Lawrence is going to be selling books over there at the table, and I'm sure we'll be happy to talk to you and answer any further questions you have. Again, you're continuing to deliberate on how you're going to vote on the resolution. Noemi, I guess you'll tell me once we want to close the voting. Okay, it looks like we're going to close the voting. Going once, going twice, going three times. And Noemi's bringing up the results to me. Please hand them to me, Noemi. Okay. All right. Those who voted, you understand that the way to win this debate is not how many voted initially, because that's just our baseline. That establishes the position of the audience. And so, first of all, I want to say to both speakers that you did both pick up votes. Interestingly enough, Lawrence climbed out of an 8.2% vote in his favor, and he got up to 11.8%. So he picked up 3.5 percentage points. But Camille started from 48% and went up to 75%, so he picked up 27%. So technically, the Tootsie Roll goes to Camille, but both guys did manage to sway a few votes. So congratulations to you both.
No worries.